listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. The AIDS epidemic began in this country just over three decades ago. In New York City alone, more than 81,000 people have died from the disease, which of course remains with us to this day, infecting people at an increasing rate. My guest today argues that when AIDS struck in the early 1980s, it had tremendous political as well as devastating personal consequences. She posits that it helped facilitate the enormous gentrification of cities like New York and San Francisco, erasing a radical and oppositional queer culture, which was ultimately replaced by a conservative one. Sarah Shulman teaches English at the City University of New York, College of Staten Island, and is the author of a new book from UC Press titled The Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination. She's also the co-producer of the film United in Anger, A History of ACT UP, and co-founder of the ACT UP Oral History Project. Sarah, I'd like to start by asking you, what's the dominant way that the mainstream tends to remember the height of the AIDS epidemic, the years from 1981 to 1996?
Well, they're hardly remembered at all. There's very little reference in popular conversation to the epicenter of the AIDS crisis. There's certainly no recognition that there's any consequence of those 15 years of mass death, in which 500,000 people died in this country of AIDS. So I would say it's pretty much forgotten.
I wonder then if you can bring us back to those years and remind us what the reality was like for people during that time, which in your book you refer to as a time of mass death and mass indifference.
Well, I mean, now we know that AIDS was first appeared in the 1940s. The earliest examples we have are sailors who died of pneumocystis pneumonia, and the doctors identified them as having had anal trauma. So they were having anal sex, and they died of an infection that later was associated with AIDS. In the 60s, there was something called junkie pneumonia, where junkies would notice that each other would die, again, of pneumocystis pneumonia. And there also was something called the dropsies, which was basically wasting syndrome, and that was a term used by homeless people and drug addicts. But it was not identified as a phenomena until 1981. And that was the famous case article in the New York Times that a small amount of cases of what they called a gay cancer had appeared in a group of gay men. And this syndrome was then called GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. So from the beginning, despite its actual history, it was recognized as a disease linked to homosexuality, even though nobody knew at the time how it was transmitted. So in 1981, gay sex was still illegal in the United States. There were, in most places, it was legal to discriminate against gay people in terms of jobs, housing, public accommodations. People could be refused service in restaurants, kicked out of hotels. So you had a group of people who had absolutely no legal rights, and who also were highly stigmatized and were subjected to rejection by their families, by their societies, and who had no accurate representation in the media. So it was a very dire situation for that community to be hit suddenly with an inexplicable lethal illness. And the story of AIDS activism is really the story of a despised group of people with no rights who joined together and forced this country to change against its will, thereby saving each other's lives. And that process basically took 15 years.
You have been involved in trying to record the history of that time, including through an oral history project of the pioneering activist group ACT UP, which stands for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. How was ACT UP formed, and what was its purpose?
Okay, well, so AIDS, or GRID, was first identified in 1981. And from 1981 to 1987, 40,000 people died of what was then known as AIDS, or ARC, Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. eventually, within that period, it was identified that AIDS was caused by a virus called HIV, and that it was transmitted by blood to blood or semen to blood. So it was either sexually transmitted or transmitted by sharing needles. Now, in those first 5 years, it was so chaotic, and the death rates zoomed so incredibly. People were diagnosed, and then they'd be dead in a number of weeks. You know, it was normal to see somebody and then never see them again. I mean, there was absolutely no treatment. And also, the treatment system was very hostile to people with AIDS. So, you know, if you were admitted to a hospital, it would be common that the nurses didn't want to come into the room, or the orderlies would leave the food out in the hall. Nobody was studying the disease, and there was no impetus for anyone to study how to treat it. And so it was very, very chaotic. There were groups like Gay Men's Health Crisis that was formed in the early 80s, and there was a People with AIDS Coalition. But there was but most of these groups had to do with trying to address the crisis, the health crisis, in terms of providing buddies, getting people the basic attention that they needed. But there was no political movement designed to force the society to respond. And so in February 1987, ACT UP was formed. That's the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. The impetus for this was a speech by Larry Kramer, who at that time was a playwright and novelist, screenwriter, who had been one of the founders of Gay Men's Health Crisis, and who had been frustrated that Gay Men's Health Crisis did not have a political action component. He felt that they were turning into a social service agency, and there was nothing that would propel the society forward. When Nora Ephron had to cancel a talk she was supposed to give at the Lesbian and Gay Community Center, as it was called at the time, in New York, Larry Kramer came in as a last-minute substitute, and he gave a speech in which he asked the audience to look to their right, look to the left, and he said, each of you will be dead within 6 months. And he invited the audience to do something about it. Then a group of people met the following week, and they started to call themselves ACT UP. And this was a very interesting collection of people. It was people who did not know each other. Many of them had no political experience whatsoever. And they joined with an art project called the Silence Equals Death Project. That was a collective that included Avram Finkelstein and a number of other artists. And so they had made a poster of an upside-down pink triangle with the slogan, Silence Equals Death, underneath the poster. And at that time, there was a lot of construction in New York City, and there were a lot of construction sites, and they wheat-pasted this poster all over the West Village. So they joined together, and that slogan became the slogan of this new movement, ACT UP. And ACT UP's first action was at Wall Street, ironically, now that we have the Occupy Wall Street movement. And it was to try to get the price of AZT to be lowered. Now, AZT was a failed cancer drug that was trying to be recycled into AIDS. And the first treatments that were, almost all of the first treatments available for AIDS were failures. There was an egg lipid called AL721 that people were spreading on their toast. There were drugs called dextrin sulfate. There was a whole bunch of medication that didn't work. And a lot of them were recycled pharmaceuticals that had not worked primarily for cancer. And the biggest one was AZT. AZT became the largest profit-making pharmaceutical in the history of the world. It was prescribed for people with AIDS at very, very high dosages, and it was very expensive. I believe it was $10,000 a year. I'm not sure about that at the beginning. And, of course, people with AIDS could not get insurance at that time. Many people who took it died of lymphoma that was caused by the high dosage. But at any rate, the first demonstration was to get Burroughs Wellcome, the company that made AZT, to lower the price so that it would be accessible. After that, ACT UP did come up with a very brilliant plan called Parallel Track, in which new drugs would be made available to people at much lower cost as they were, by participating in experimental drug trials before they were approved by the FDA. And this made a wider range of medications available to people with HIV and AIDS. But ACT UP had to come up, had to invent the system. In fact, it was Jim Igoe in ACT UP who invented Parallel Track, that to start to reform the system. And that's when ACT UP realized that basically asking science to do their job was not going to work, that we had to do the job. So people inside ACT UP became experts at the epidemiology of HIV and its treatment. And eventually ACT UP did set the research agenda for pharma and for the government and force them to follow that research agenda, resulting 15 years later in the protease inhibitors, which were the first successful drugs for AIDS, which are commonly known as the cocktail.
And ACT UP was involved in some very high-profile direct actions. They were, in some ways, kind of pioneering. Can you tell us about some of the tactics that ACT UP used?
I'll tell you, they used some time-true tactics, and they used some brand-new tactics. Interestingly, ACT UP pretty much adopted the same concept of nonviolent civil disobedience that Martin Luther King had used and that he lays out in his article, Letter from Birmingham Jail. But they didn't know it. They didn't know that they were using that system. But basically what it was the first step was what Dr. King called self-education, that people in ACT UP became the experts and then proposed reasonable and doable solutions to the powers that be. And then when the powers that be refused to respond, ACT UP would go, commit nonviolent civil disobedience that would force institutions to respond. So the most famous example is when the Catholic Church was involved, got very involved with the public schools of New York City, and got in place a restriction on condom distribution in the public schools. And we knew that people would die because of this policy. So since the church had gone into the public sector and was causing people's deaths, we felt we had the right to go into their sector. And so 7,000 people came to an ACT UP demonstration, surrounded St. Patrick's Cathedral on a Sunday, and inside the cathedral disrupted the mass, saying that we're fighting for your lives too. And I can tell you that today, condoms are available in the New York City public schools. So that was a perfect example of a successful action.
And ACT UP also structured campaigns around women with AIDS. And obviously, gay men were particularly hard hit by this epidemic. But ACT UP worked to bring the needs of women with AIDS into the forefront. Tell us about that.
ACT UP profoundly transformed the situation for women with AIDS in this country. And the men of ACT UP were 100% behind it. It was a four-year campaign that the entire organization participated in. Basically, the situation was that the Center for Disease Control had an official definition of AIDS. In other words, that you had to have a certain number of T cells and you had to have certain symptoms in order to qualify as officially having AIDS. But none of the symptoms that only women had were on the list. So women could die of AIDS and never get an official diagnosis. And what that meant was not only could they never get benefits, but they couldn't be tested, treatments couldn't be developed. They were completely excluded from any progress in the field. And so ACT UP did a four-year campaign that forced the Center for Disease Control to change the definition of what constitutes AIDS. And this let huge numbers of people into the system, both for benefits and services and also for treatment. Now, many of the leaders of that movement were women of color who were HIV positive. There's only one or two who are still alive today. Most of them have died of AIDS. But they were the founders of the Women with AIDS Empowerment Movement. They were in leadership in those movements. And in fact, if you see our new film, Jim Hubbard and I just co-produced a film that he directed called United in Anger, A History of ACT UP, which is a feature film that's now showing at film festivals around the world. It will be at the Frameline Festival in San Francisco soon. And in that, in our film, you can see footage of these women who were the leaders of this early movement, giving speeches, leading demonstrations, being arrested, kicking and screaming in the rain, fighting until the end of their lives, as most people with AIDS did in that movement, and being successful.
As you argue in your book, Gentrification of the Mind, the most gentrified areas of New York were those areas where there were the highest rates of AIDS. And you make an argument about gentrification being very much facilitated by the high death rate of people living in rent-controlled apartments in various neighborhoods. I want you to tell us about that, but I wonder if you could first talk about the history of gentrification in the U.S. leading up to the 1970s, during the time that you're focusing on, that gentrification accelerated as the AIDS epidemic really exploded.
Well, actually, if you look at the whole country, you can see, I mean, the most gentrified cities in America are San Francisco and New York City. And these were the cities with the highest rates of AIDS deaths. What happened in New York is that after World War II, there was a GI Bill. And the GI Bill entitled veterans to very low interest mortgages on these new developments, the new suburbs that were being created on the outside of the city. But because those suburbs were often racist, this access, move to the suburbs, was often pretty much restricted to ethnic whites. So you had a lot of Italians and Jews and Irish urban young people moving to the suburbs and buying these homes at low interest. Now, this, they had come from urbanity, and urbanity is based on mix. It's based on the knowledge and experience of living with people who are different from you every day. And the dynamic of urbanity is what makes cities a place that produce ideas for the world. They produce new art ideas. They produce revolutionary political ideas. Gay liberation was not born in Scarsdale, right? It was born in cities. Same thing for Black Power. The most important American movements come from cities. Now, when these white people moved to the suburbs, they moved into very stratified living conditions, and their children were raised in racial segregation, in privatized private homes, in compulsory heterosexuality, very gender stratified situations with a lot of homogenization, and of course car culture and consumer culture. And this produced the first generation of people who were suburbanized. The first suburbanites were produced by that phenomena. Now, in the 70s, New York City was what was called white flight. So these white people through GI Bill had left the city. The city was underpopulated. There was a lot of housing. Some people, you could get a few months free rent for signing a lease. A rent could be $60 a month or $100 a month. It was a very open city, not strongly policed. And in the middle of the 1970s, the city went bankrupt. This allowed the city fathers to bring in a policy of where they decided to gentrify the city. They stopped building low-income housing, and they started giving corporate welfare for luxury development. So you start to see, instead of low-income housing, you start to see a lot of condo conversion and luxury rentals, and a lot of money going into housing that only wealthier people could afford. What the city was told was that once wealthier people came to the city, we would have an expanded tax base, and then we'd be able to fund all our services. Of course, now, 40 years later, New York City is overflowing with rich people, and we're constantly still closing schools, shutting hospitals, cutting mass transit. So basically, that was a lie, and the whole thing was money for the real estate developers who had tax breaks to make this money. But as this began, the new tenants that they were attracting to this new luxury housing were the children of the people of white flight, the children who had grown up in a gated community mentality, who had a sentimental attachment to the city because their parents had grown up there, perhaps they had gone to visit their grandparents there, and who were willing to trade freedom for security because they had grown up in these very stratified suburban culture. It was the first suburban generation. They moved back to the city, but unlike the many, many, many people who had moved to New York City in the past, I mean, Heartland whites had always moved to New York City, but they had moved there to become New Yorkers. They had moved there to get away from their families, to escape religion, to have sex, to make art, to make, you know, for all these kinds of reasons. But this group was really different because they were coming from suburban culture, from consumer culture, from a kind of mass culture that had never existed before. And they came to New York not to become New Yorkers, but to change New York. So they came with a desire to homogenize and also an obedience to security and authority. So you start to see profound cultural changes in the city.
So who was displaced in this process?
For example, New York City went from 47% white to 57% white in 10 years. And it's a different kind of white. The first whites were ethnic whites or, you know, artists or gay people who were seeking some kind of real life. And they're replaced by a more suburban kind of white who might be more likely to be working in the financial business or who's coming in with a completely different kind of attitude. So the way the city describes itself starts to change. So if you take a neighborhood that was once very diverse in terms of income, race, ethnic background, like my neighborhood, the East Village, for example. As it becomes homogenized and this type of suburbanized white starts to move in, you start to see, for example, as the neighborhood becomes dangerous to its inhabitants, it starts to be described as getting better. Even though from the viewpoint of the people who live there, it's getting worse. So you see there's a point of view shift and how the city is described and how it describes itself. And basically, the multi-ethnic and diverse communities become replaced by these homogenous white tenants who also have a homogenized aesthetic taste. So they're more interested in chain stores. They're more interested in a certain kind of whitewashed food. They really like things that are blander and more repetitive. And that's what starts to come in and become urban life. But accompanying them are all these other institutional transformations, because don't forget that the people who died of AIDS, and in New York City, 80,000 people died of AIDS, which is very significant, especially if you contrast it to, for example, 9/11, where 3,000 people died in 9/11. And look at how traumatic that was for the city. So this is 80,000. The kinds of people who died of AIDS were much more oppositional people than the people who replaced them. You know, this was old school artists, people who had not gone to MFA programs, who were not professionalized. Old school gay people, these were drug users. They were people who were not integrated enough into the power system to be able to afford the high rents. So you would have someone, for example, in my building, a young dancer died of AIDS in apartment 8, and he paid, I think it was $300 a month. And then when his apartment was replaced, because this mass death overturning of apartments was happening right in the middle of gentrification, the tenant who replaced him paid $1,200 a month.
So the old rent-controlled apartment went right out the window.
One of the problems was that one of the issues was that gay partners did not have the right to inherit apartments. So if your lover died of AIDS, you would be evicted. So every time a leaseholder died of AIDS, an apartment went to market rate. So in key New York neighborhoods that had very high AIDS rates, like Harlem, Lower East Side, Chelsea, East Village, West Village, these neighborhoods had very, very rapid turnover to market rate. And so the gentrification of those neighborhoods was highly accelerated. Whereas, in contrast, if you look at something like the Upper East Side, which had a very low AIDS death rate, there's been almost no gentrification there. In fact, it's now cheaper to live there than it is to live in the Lower East Side.
Amazing. Well, there is an argument that artists or gay men, usually white gay men, have been at the forefront of gentrification.
Yes.
That neighborhoods that were populated by poor people of color would then have artists or white gay men move in, start fixing up the areas that they're in, and unwittingly opening the way for further gentrification. However, you argue that
I think it's
that's
much
an
more
incomplete story. Yes, so tell us why.
The first thing is, you know, and I know because I was guilty of this myself, there was a perception that artists were causing gentrification at the time. But the truth is, gentrification was a city policy. An enormous amount of capital was committed to developing luxury housing. But that was invisible to us at the time. Nobody moving in and rehabbing a house causes gentrification. Gentrification is caused by a kind of strategic development. So it's actually a much more sophisticated process than we all understood it to be. So, but I would say that gay men dying had far more impact on gentrification than gay men living. At the same time, there was enormous racism in the white gay male community in terms of how they treated neighborhoods of color when white gay men were moving in and rehabbing housing. That is absolutely the truth. But I'm saying that that in and of itself did not cause gentrification.
So what did these tremendous forces happening at the same time, the spread of the AIDS epidemic, how it particularly affected gay culture, and at the same time, a process of gentrification, which, as you say, in places like New York and elsewhere, had started before the AIDS epidemic became so intense, but was accelerated by that process. How did all of these things together end up shaping or reshaping gay culture?
Well, it's completely transformed it. The first thing is that, I mean, it's very hard to, it's not just one reason. But you have to look at a lot of factors. I really think that gay people were profoundly traumatized by the mass death experience of the AIDS crisis. Because one of the things that we learned was that nobody cared what happened to us. And, you know, if you look at gay people today, especially people who lived in San Francisco and New York in that era, so that would be gay people, you know, in their late 40s or older, they went through serious trauma. They witnessed and experienced constant death of the people closest to them in a context of complete indifference by the government and by the families of their friends and by the society in which they lived. That has to have an impact on people. I mean, the silence around that experience pretends that it has no impact, but it has enormous impact. And what it reminds me of is a little bit, it reminds me of the way Jewish Americans behaved after World War II, when there was a profound assimilation push, you know, into Americanization. It's people who assimilate into the societies that allow them to be destroyed. And there's an unconscious underpinning that I think has a lot of repulsion of trying to be safe. Even, and I think that it carries on even to people who did not profoundly experience AIDS firsthand. You know, that this whole kind of gay 1950s that we're in now, with this drive towards privatized family units, marriage, parenthood, this real push to be like a certain kind of heterosexual person, which we already know that lifestyle doesn't work for them. I mean, we already know about very high divorce rates, right? We already know about fractured families. We already know that privatized living doesn't... If gay people had been divided into privatized family units at the time of the AIDS crisis, we never would have had AIDS activism because they wouldn't have been able to respond as a community. We already know that losing the community-based relationship is a terrible mistake and has horrible consequences. And yet we're driving wildly in that direction, you know, into systems that haven't worked for straight people. And I think a lot of it is the trauma of the AIDS crisis. That's part of it. So, you know, that's had an enormous effect. Of course, the death of the leadership is, you know, an entire generation of gay men who were particularly oppositional in terms of their sexual practices and values, who were very advanced in the arts, who were pioneers in many arenas. That whole generation never lived to be the leaders, to be the teachers, to be the directors of organizations, to be the mentors. They were completely removed. And their whole value system was removed. It was silenced. And their culture was silenced. So now we have this very... I often think if straight people knew that gay marriage doesn't mean monogamy in the way that they imagine it to mean, they may not support it in the way that they do. I'm not sure, you know, there's supposed to be this pretense now of adopting into a kind of heterosexual paradigm of sexual culture. But gay people had their own sexual culture, and that, although it still exists, it exists in a very underground way. It's not part of our public discourse at all. You know, I was thinking the other day when I'm 53, when I was just coming out, the most common story that you would hear from men was that when they were teenagers in whatever small town they were living in, they would have sex with older men, and that that was part of the whole coming out experience. It was considered very normal, and it was described in a positive way. Today, if anyone discussed that has been completely removed from the public discourse of gay experience. You know, now we have these very, very gender normative, everything about how we describe ourselves fits into a heterosexual paradigm. So we're in a strange kind of duplicity with ourselves. I mean, fortunately, it can't last. You know, and hopefully there will be another gay or queer, more likely a queer sexual revolution again, where it becomes more open. But right now, we're in a very, very conservative period. And then, of course, there's the rise of these behemoth national gay organizations that spend hundreds of millions of dollars, that are entirely top-down, that are not effective, that have no relationship to the grassroots of the communities, and that are really retrograde politically. And, you know, and that is also a consequence of that time, because AIDS brought enormous visibility to those kinds of organizations and allowed them to propel themselves into much larger budgets that I don't think they're serving anybody. So the whole landscape has been transformed by this.
Against the Grain is the program. Sarah Schulman is my guest. We'll return with her after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're discussing the political consequences of the AIDS epidemic. My guest is Sarah Schulman, who's written a type of memoir about what she calls the plague years of the AIDS epidemic and the consequences of those years for radical queer culture and politics. The name of the book is Gentrification of the Mind: Witness to a Lost Imagination. It's published by UC Press, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She teaches English at the City University of New York, the College of Staten Island, and among other things, is the co-producer of United in Anger, A History of ACT UP. So you've been describing the transformation of radical queer culture in the 1970s through gentrification and the AIDS epidemic, and its replacement by a conservative culture, including a conservative queer culture. Do you see this as just being part of a larger process of a kind of backlash from the radical movements of the 60s and 70s? Or is there something particular to queer culture that you see within this?
Well, there's been a profound misrepresentation of who is queer and what our experiences are. So, for example, we went through the Don't Ask, Don't Tell campaign, you know, to end job discrimination in the military. And instead of looking at this as a labor issue, which is what it is, because it's only poor people who go into the military, and instead of looking at it as the racial issue that it was, since black women were ejected from the military for being gay at much higher rates than white males, we were presented with this very nationalistic campaign orchestrated by gay people about patriotism and our desire to be part of two immoral wars in Iraq and Afghanistan against Muslim people, and that the gay leadership was co-opted into that type of argument, misrepresenting what the issues were and misrepresenting who we are, was really tragic. Now, what's interesting is the very moment that you and I are having this conversation is a very actually exciting moment in queer politics, because there's now a whole new impulse going on, which is the global organizing. There are emerging LGBT movements all over the world. Remember we used to say we are everywhere? Well, guess what? It was true. So we're seeing movements. We're seeing Palestinian gay movement. We're seeing gay movements in the Arab world. We're seeing gay movements in Africa. We're seeing gay movements in Turkey and Pakistan. We're seeing a kind of new queer movement emerging that is very politicized, that is anti-occupation, that is anti-racist, that is pro-immigration, because it's coming from countries where people are immigrants to the West and who are experiencing anti-immigrant racism. It's a much more politicized queer movement, very much like the original queer movement was when it first started. And they are really taking the lead, and they're very far ahead. In the West, we're behind. So what we're going through now is what Rutgers professor Jasbir Poor has called homo nationalism. And this is what's dominating in the West. It's as white gay people get certain kinds of rights, they start to identify with racist and nationalist paradigms that we used to be excluded from because of homophobia. So you start to see, for example, in the Netherlands, where basically gay people have the same rights as everybody else, you start to see a lot of very high numbers of queer people in the white people in the Netherlands joining right-wing anti-immigrant parties. Or for example, in Britain, the English Defense League, which is a secular right-wing movement, has an LGBT wing. Because now what's happened is the only people who really are anti-gay in this world are religious people. The secular right wing is no longer anti-gay, and they are now co-opting white gay people who are living in places where homophobia is not the contradiction that it once was. So, for example, in Germany last year, Judith Butler, the theorist, turned down an award from the Christopher Street Committee of the German gay movement because they had anti-Muslim politics and were taking anti-immigrant positions. So what you're seeing basically is a division, a global division in the LGBT world between the homo nationalists, who are the assimilationists, who are going for nationalism, who are going for white supremacy, who are anti-immigrant, and basically the queers, which are the anti-occupation people who are anti-racist in there and who are forming a global movement. And you see this split in every major city, even in Tel Aviv. On Gay Pride Day, you have separate events for the homo nationalist LGBT community, which supports the occupation and is nationalist, and the queers, who are known as the queerim, right? They're the anti-occupation queer Israelis. They have separate events. In Toronto, this division was so profound that a group called Queers United Against Israeli Apartheid was kicked out of the Toronto Pride March. And then finally they were readmitted when the community objected. And then I told you about the division in Berlin. In New York City, we have separate events. We have the corporate LGBT parade, and then we have the trans march, the dyke march, and the drag march, none of which have police permits and are queer. So you're seeing this division in all the major cities, and you're seeing it globally. And I think it's a great thing, because then people like myself, who have a freedom vision that's broad, don't have to worry about groups like HRC and all these hugely overfunded, pointless homo-nationalist groups in the U.S., because we have nothing to do with them anymore. We're like on two separate tracks, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, what about the realm of academia? Mm-hmm. There's been a real flowering of theory around queerness and all sorts of related questions. You mention in your book, The Gentrification of the Mind, a kind of gap, a generation gap between older, more radicalized gays or queers, and then younger people who are queer and feel less of a connection to that kind of radical history and radical politics. Do you see any disconnect between the fact that, you know, one can take courses now in queer theory in universities, but that kind of radical tradition of activism seems to be almost forgotten?
Well, I would separate that into two different questions. The first is what has happened with the academic queer realm. I mean, basically, this was a community demand, just like Black studies was a demand of the Black Power movement, right? Women's studies of the Women's Liberation Movement. This was academic programs that were propelled by grassroots radical movements. And then once they were in place, they ended up basically creating a class split, like a town gown split, and dividing the communities basically according to class access. So we then produced this kind of academic queer sector of people who would come out in college, who would stay inside their class boundaries, would not socialize in the general queer communities outside of their own academic framework. And this was disastrous because it divides the movement and depoliticizes everything. On the other hand, what we're seeing now, I think that the new generation, that's to say that the 20s, the queer people in their 20s, are a very exciting generation because they are coming up during the time of all this economic upheaval. And so they're being saddled, they see immediately what the problems of the economic system are. They're saddled with enormous student loan debt. There's no yuppie path out there for them. They have rents they can't afford. They have to cobble together income. There's no jobs. And it puts them in a much more critical position to the system, a much more informed analytical position. And I'm finding that with my new book, it's people in their 20s who are the greatest fans of the book and who are reading it in the largest numbers and who are getting in touch with me and who are getting the most out of it. So, you know, and they're part of the Occupy generation. So there's a new rebellion going on, and there's a new generation that needs things to change. And that's very, very exciting because the yuppies drove me crazy, you know, and thank God that time is over for now. But in terms of those of us who are in the academy, we have responsibility to transform these paradigms of separation. I can tell you that at the City University Graduate Center, we're having a conference next year in April 2013, on homo-nationalism and pinkwashing. And we're hoping that this will be a conference of academics and activists and artists, which is what these meeting gatherings should be. They should not be stratified. They should be mixed. To articulate this new global queer movement that I've just been describing to you. In fact, if people go to the website for CLAG, Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies, there is a call for papers out right now for that conference, and they can submit proposals. So, you know, we're trying to open that up, the queer academy, and make it something, a place that actually has more application for action.
Sarah Schulman is my guest. She's the author of Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination, and she teaches English at the City University of New York College of Staten Island. So you were describing the divergent politics of queer people in America right now, the more conservative mainstream politics, which you characterize as homo-nationalist, and a more radical, expansive queer politics that connects economic and social and sexuality and so on. Is there any danger of that latter group, the more radical group, ultimately being co-opted by the politics of the more conservative, given that they have enormous economic resources, or do you think they are so divergent that co-optation is not really an issue here?
Queer people who are on the ball are totally alienated by these national gay organizations like LAD and HRC. I think that, you know, they don't speak to them at all. And there's no danger of that. The challenge for them is to learn how to be effective organizers and to take action. They've been bred to be passive. And one of the ways they've been bred that way is they've been told that things are better than they are, which is always very dangerous. You know, one of the advantages that older queer people had is that we were only told terrible things about ourselves, and we knew that those things weren't true. But younger people are being told that everything is great, and all they have to do is get married and have children, and then they're going to be normal, and then they're going to have this great life. And fighting against that is much more difficult. So learning how to use your actual lived experience and to privilege that over the stories you're told about yourself is the first step, and then they have to learn concrete organizing. That's the challenge. But it's a very exciting generation, and I'm very relieved to see them here.
Well, since obviously AIDS did not go away
right.
in 1996, what's your assessment of the state of AIDS activism today?
AIDS activism is a very difficult thing right now because the grassroots communities lost control of AIDS, right? AIDS was taken over by international pharmaceuticals and NGOs. So decisions are made at very, very high levels that are very hard to interact with, especially in an international theater. So, you know, with the global AIDS crisis that we have now is a crisis of political will. It's not like the former AIDS crisis, not because we don't know what causes the virus, we don't know how to treat it. We do know what causes it, and we do know how to treat it. But what we don't have is the political will to have equitable distribution of resources around the world. And that's why we have a global AIDS crisis. The issue in the United States is a little bit different. We have a prevention crisis in the U.S., and what we see over and over again is that no matter how we restate the safe sex message, whether we use language like men who have sex with men or whether we use subway cards or whatever we do, there's a certain percentage of people year after year, younger gay men, often gay men of color, who get infected no matter what. So there's a sector of people, there's a standard percentage that are not being reached by these prevention methods. And we need to have a more radical look at the crisis of prevention. I mean, to me, it seems like you have young gay people of color in this country who are economically disenfranchised, who do not have basic legal rights, who experience familial homophobia regularly, and who are not accurately represented in arts and entertainment. And we are telling these people that prevention is their private problem, that they have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and they have to keep themselves from getting infected. And that combination of completely alienating them and then expecting them to take responsibility at that level, it's a contradiction. It's not successful. And what you need is a prevention movement that's politicized about how young gay men and young gay men of color are treated in this country. What are their job prospects? What are their educational prospects? How do their families treat them? I mean, it's addressing those issues that will change the infection rates. Unfortunately, we have a prevention establishment that's highly funded and bureaucratized and it's not a grassroots movement, and it's not in any kind of dynamic relationship to the culture. But there are younger people with good ideas. I mean, there was a guy, Darnell Moore, who works with homeless LGBT kids in Newark, and he was saying that HIV prevention should be done at home. You know, that he wanted to do a Mother's Day campaign, mothers, love your gay sons, that this is something that should be part of the family conversation and be taking place in the private sphere. And that's, you know, that's a very interesting idea. And I'd love to see that publicized. It's a revolutionary way of approaching this. So, you know, obviously prevention has to be rethought.
Well, lastly, you make the claim, or at least it's a speculation, that this process that you've described earlier in the program of gentrification, which really transforms cities, their artist communities, their queer life, their radicalism, that may be coming to an end with this economic crash. Here in the Bay Area, the crash actually has allowed for gentrification to proceed apace since foreclosed houses are now being bought up and flipped and sold to more affluent people. But what is it about this moment that gives you hope for that process to maybe slow down?
Well, I think that, you know, the major thing that can cause people to rethink are the lack of opportunities for young people. I know that my students, when they and I teach in the public university, so I have poor and working class students. They graduate from CUNY with a BA, and they cannot get a job. I mean, it's a year later, and they're still living in their parents' house, and they have never worked. We're now seeing a generation that has never had a job. That reality, I think, is what's going to propel social change more than anything else.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Schulman has been my guest. She is the author of Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination, published by UC Press. We have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's also the author of Stage Struck, Theater Aids in the Marketing of Gay America, and My American History, Lesbian and Gay Life During the Reagan-Bush Years. She's Distinguished Professor of English at CUNY Staten Island and co-founder of the ACT UP Oral History Project. We also have a link to that on our website. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Please tune in again next time. Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Mike Bakes.